Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. This is a bonus episode, and I am one of your hosts, Luke Johnson. I am an assistant professor at the University of Utah in pediatric and general dermatology. And with me, of course...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I am an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
So in episode 29, we discussed an article about what they call the Gabrin sign, about people with androgenetic alopecia having more morbidity and mortality from COVID. And a couple of the authors are here with us today. Thanks so much for coming on the show, guys. Do you want to start by introducing yourselves and giving us a little bit of your background?
Thank you, Luke. My name is Dr. Carlos Villanger. I'm an assistant professor of dermatology here at Brown Dermatology. I'm a Brazilian dermatologist, and I'm a specialist in cosmetic dermatology. I'm an expert in chemical peels. And I have my science doctorate in infectious diseases. I'm an expert in leprosy immunology. And yes, it's exciting to contribute with COVID-19 and also with our understanding of hair biology and male hormones and how all that adds up to the disease vulnerability.
Muito obrigada.
You also have an excellent accent. I guess we should mention that our guests today are a couple of the authors from the review we did about the Gabrin sign, about androgenetic alopecia and its association with COVID morbidity and mortality.
And I'm Dr. Andy Gorin. I'm affiliated with both Applied Biology, which is a biotech company primarily working on androgenetic alopecia, and I'm also affiliated with various universities, both in Europe and the United States. I work with the group at Brown, with Carlos on research, primarily again on hair and alopecia. I was the first person actually to publish the genetics of androgen sensitivity and female pattern hair loss for drug response. About maybe 12, 14 years ago, we did research on that. We found epigenetic markers that predict response to finasteride in women, pattern hair loss, as well as identifying the gene for, or one of the genes on the androgen receptor and allele for male pattern baldness. So I've been involved in quite a lot of different research. Vitiligo has been one of the specialties I've done, and I've had a lot of residents work with me on vitiligo and genetics. Herpes simplex was another area that I worked on. I'm a big proponent of pathogen-driven diseases, both dermatology and other diseases, as a sort of an initiator for diseases. I guess Carlos and I are collaborating primarily, this is before COVID, we're working, I'm working there as a co-research with them on hair. We dived into COVID sort of by necessity, like everybody else in the world, and we came from it from the angle of really hair and androgens, and it was just a connection that we made when we noticed that the specific, I don't know if you want me to dive into it, is that okay? Or?
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, so we noticed that there is a specific enzyme, TMPRSS2, which is one of the two enzymes that's required for the SARS-CoV-2 to enter the type 2 pneumocytes in lung cells. And as Carlos and I discussed, it was the only known, and I emphasize known because there's things that are not known, a promoter for that is an androgen response element. And so from that, we kind of deduce, hey, androgens, well, we talk about it as androgens. So what does this have to do with androgenetic alopecia? And so we actually, I'm affiliated with University of Madrid, Ramon Cajal Hospital, which is probably the most prestigious and largest one in Madrid. And our colleague, Sergio Ivano Galvan, is the head of the dermatology, and I said, you know, obviously I can't travel and visit you, but maybe since it's public hospital and the people are all working now in the emergency department, we can take a look in a sequential sort of semi-randomized way if people are coming into the hospital, and let us see how many patients that are presenting are presenting with androgenetic alopecia or female pattern hair loss. We look actually at both, not just males. So I know there's a lot of talk about males, and maybe later we can dive into it. But we look both in males and females. And in fact, I've asked in several interviews and several things, people ask me, why just males, why just males? So we actually have a preference for females rather than males. And most of the research in my life was a female pattern hair loss, not on males. But unfortunately, we didn't see, at least in the COVID-19, that pattern as well. Carlos can comment more about that because he analyzed more of the data on the female. But it doesn't mean that there's no connection with androgens. It just means we haven't seen it. It could be also, you know, hirsutism or something else. But anyway, we got the initial data and it was very exciting. And then we did some other studies and we've seen more and more of that connection between males are being hospitalized and these are the severe symptoms and androgenetic alopecia, or at least I think it was Norwood 3 and above.
Yes, we can go over the results and with the comparison with previous data. But look, let me tell you something. I've known Andy for some time now, and the day that I met him, we were in this World Congress of Hair Research in Barcelona, and I gave this lecture there about drug tattooing in the scalp with dutasteride and minoxidil to promote hair growth. And Andy gave a great lecture there about the role of aspirin in minoxidil and everything. So after our lectures, he came up to me and said, "Hey, Carlos, we should collaborate together. I like your lecture." And I said, "Oh, me too." And one thing that I always found fascinating in working with Andy is that I can speak to him in a scientific language and he understands. Because most of the researchers I've worked with, when they go deep into details of genetics, or they don't understand anymore. It's like they lose the interest. While with Andy, I could talk about everything I wanted about hair biology, procedures, genetics. He's a hair specialist who knows the biology. And you know, when we've been working together and when COVID started, it was very interesting that the same scientific minds that were working together with other things, all of a sudden we started to focus on the protease that primes the spikes of the virus. And then we try to put the word out there. And it's been very gratifying to see that people now are starting to comment about the male vulnerability, and especially the males who have more androgen sensitivity because of genetics, and which are the ones that are bald and or have enlarged prostate or other male characteristics.
You can't see the enlarged prostate, right? From the outside as easily as the bald.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. They can build a scanner for that maybe now.
You know, I think that they're very handsome men. So they're very handsome men, and they're sort of supermen because they have this androgen sensitivity, and they're a little bit more on, I think, the end of hypermasculinity, which, you know, in some ways is supposed to be a sort of definitive trait that acquires sort of refinement over time. So it's just so neat to hear a discussion about how we as dermatologists can potentially help to define risk and localize new options for therapeutic intervention. So one thing that was fascinating when I started reading about this, the temptress, I like the way you say that because it sounds kind of like temptress, so it's kind of fun.
Saucy.
Right, exactly.
Actually, I have to disclose this. We didn't come up with this pronunciation, so we've been involved with the prostate cancer group, mm-hmm. and the temptress 2 ERG is actually an oncogene that's involved in 50% of prostates, and so prostate cancer. So we learned that this is how they pronounce it. So we're just using this pronunciation now.
I like it a lot. I think it's really interesting. It seems to also have potentially some role pathogenically with certain strains of influenza. So it's a really interesting protein. And what I've been kind of fascinated by, because we've got sort of a wave of hormonal modification, both anti and pro-androgen in our society. There's a lot of these sort of low T clinics and things like that popping up, where people can, you know, stop and get their blood work done and get those testosterone pellets or the cream and things like that. I'm wondering if that's going to affect patients' risk. I looked into the anti-androgens to see if that was potentially a therapeutic option, and people are looking into it. Do you guys have any insight on that?
Let me just say one thing regarding that. I'm fascinated that there's been a lot of evidence on many medications that we use for actually hyperandrogen or let's say features like metformin. We've been seeing that metformin improves COVID-19. There's so many medications that regulate somehow androgens, even though they're not specifically anti-androgens. So we've been seeing that in the recent reports. But do you want to comment anything in?
Yeah, well, I want to give a word of caution about when we talk about androgens. So a lot of people equate the androgens with like testosterone levels, and I think this is a mistake. And in fact, some studies might conclude the wrong results with that. So when I talk about androgen, and I think that most of the people, at least in the androgenetic alopecia area, understand that we don't think about androgen as serum androgen levels. There is a correlation. We think about tissue androgen levels, and androgens are generated in the tissue. So when I think about baldness in men or male pattern hair loss, I really think about men that are genetically predisposed, which is necessary but not sufficient, and have high local DHT levels in their scalp tissue. So that's the sort of phenotype plus genotype that I'm looking at. I'm saying, well, this is somebody at a high risk. In females, it's a little bit less obvious, so it's more complicated because we have two X chromosomes and the differential activation, all that. But now if we take and translate that into the prostate, and I'm going back to prostate, and I'll tell you why in a second, but in the prostate, it's a similar mechanism that's happening. From what I understand in the prostate, what we have is, again, DHT is generated in the prostate, and it's genetically predisposed individuals that are going to develop prostate cancer. Well, we also know that DHT is generated in the lung. Now, I cannot say with any certainty whatsoever that the same thing is going, some genetic predisposition plus DHT locally, but I would believe it probably tends to translate that way. And I keep bringing back the prostate because I think it's very important. Okay, this is a dermatology podcast, but in general, when we're talking to people, they're like, okay, these are dermatologists. What do they know about anything to do with COVID? Well, I would be the first one to claim I don't know anything about COVID, but and I don't know that anybody knew anything 6 months ago, but I still don't know anything. But what I do know is what's important is two points make a line, and I try to tell it to a lot of people, is we have two specialties in medicine. We have dermatology and we have oncology, and they have derived, maybe independently, at the same conclusion that androgens might be implicated or predispose people to severe COVID-19 disease burden. So I think that's a very important thing to keep saying to people, is that, hey, it's not just baldness, it's actually we have two points. But going back to the DHT level locally, I do want to say that we are conducting right now a study we were waiting to get the first results this week. We still haven't gotten it. On the CAG repeat in the androgen receptor, as we call it androgen sensitivity sort of test, is a predictor for COVID-19 disease severity or mortality. So this study is a prospective study. Patients first presented to the hospital are getting their DNA taken, and wow, it's getting analyzed right now. And so once we have these results, now, you know, we picked the CAG repeat just from my past experience in androgen sensitivity. Of course, there's a lot of other markers, and whether this proves true or not, I don't know. But if it does, this will be very exciting because that would be a direct correlation between androgen receptor genetics in your human genetics and the ability of the virus to probably affect you, as well as what is the chances of anti-androgen therapy working. So we think this is a very exciting opportunity to understand the whole mechanism.
And Luke and Michelle, do you understand the CAG repeats, or what happens biologically because of that in the protein, or is it something you've ever heard about?
Well, whether or not we understand it, it's probably a good idea for you to give us the nutshell version.
Yeah, so nutshell version. So there's this gene, which is the androgen receptor gene, which is in the chromosome X. So men, they only have one copy of that gene. Females, they have two chromosome X, so they have two chances of getting to polymorphisms, okay? Then if you get that gene, there's an exon that has some repeats of CAGs. The more repeats it has, the final protein will have this excess part. So it will lose its function. So the androgen receptor that is very active, it doesn't have this CAG repeats. So what happens is that it's more functional. It binds to hormones, and then it binds to DNA and promotes protein production. So we're testing if those who have longer CAG repeats, they're more protected from the virus because they produce less proteins that are promoted by the androgen receptor. And so it's a very interesting insight because this relates completely well. He started this research here on male partner hair loss with this CAG repeats long time ago, right, Andy?
Yeah, we did it in hair in women and men maybe 14 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. But what's interesting is, I want to say, I would take it as a caveat, because in women, the study is only in men, again, based first, obviously, that we only observe the observation of baldness in men. But in the same time, the study is in men because we don't understand in women how the androgen receptor is expressed. So what we have done in women with hair loss, this was again a long time ago, I published that, is we looked at scalp tissue, and in women, since we have two X chromosomes, we were able to discern based on the epigenetic expression. So you have two X chromosomes, and I'm sure most of dermatologists will know that. There is some epigenetics activation, they're differentially activated, the chromosomes, and you can actually analyze the CPG, it's called methylation analysis, and understand how much of each is expressed in each chromosome, and then you can, from that, predict the effectiveness of an anti-androgen, androgen sensitivity. Well, that's great for the scalp, and obviously it doesn't apply to prostate in women, but in the lung tissue of women, we don't know that. Now, I've been encouraging some of my colleagues to try to research that, but I don't have lung biopsy samples to run and try to test that. But that is the next thing that needs to happen in order to understand if androgens really affect women, assuming this study even works for men.
So if any of our listeners have an extensive library of lung tissue, they know where they should send it.
Yeah.
So reading some of your guys' publications, my understanding is that the implications clinically are first to recognize that people who have signs of androgen sensitivity, like pattern hair loss, might be more at risk for morbidity and mortality from COVID if you see them being wheeled into your emergency room, and potentially also to test new therapeutics that block those sorts of receptors. Is that what you guys hope is some important takeaways?
Yes, as well as the fact that we can, that's obviously the first thing that came to our mind, obviously, was, hey, these are the patients probably more risk. If we have, there was a time in the United States a couple of months ago where hospitalization priority took place. And for us, that was a sign that we need to look at when a patient is first presented, if we have a higher chance of mortality or a need for a ventilator, these might be the patients we really need to take care of. Now, again, it's a mic, it's not a guarantee, but this is what we found. What also transpired from that, and I think Carlos actually got to this concept kind of encapsulated, is the Gabrin sign. So I think we talked about it before, Frank Gabrin was the first American physician to acquire COVID-19 and die from it during work at the healthcare facility. And it was sort of an eponym that we have the Gabrin sign to look at somebody who has a male pattern baldness. But what's important about that is when you design clinical studies, we believe, you want to have patients at risk that are, more chance of, well, depends if you want to convert, avoid hospitalization, depends what kind of study you're doing. But we've been using it as a clinical study inclusion criteria. So it's not just age now or somebody with diabetes or this. Now we have also the Gabrin sign. And this study that, it was on NCT and clinicaltrials.gov, got an NCT yesterday, that one, and we're doing that again. I think we mentioned the beginning of this, or I don't know if it was recorded or not, is our dutasteride study, That one uses the gay group sign as an inclusion criteria. It's a men-only anti-androgen study.
So you're currently running this study?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, so excellent.
It's been run in Brazil. And we have our Flavio, who is an endocrinologist, who's very interested in the subject as well. We've been publishing some articles about spironolactone together. And well, Flavio, he's now the PI of that trial. And he, well, it's a randomized control trial. The control group will be taking ivermectin plus azithromycin and a placebo versus and the other group, which is ivermectin, azithromycin plus glutathione. So there will be no actual real placebo arm. Everybody will take something. That right now in Brazil, the standard of care is actually give something, either ivermectin or nitazoxanide or azithromycin or the combination of those three. So we're keeping that, the standard of care, and adding the test rate. And the interesting thing is that we're only enrolling patients over 50 years old who are in the outpatient setting who are bald, who have the gay brain sign. So we expect those patients to be the most vulnerable, to go to the hospital, you know, have more severe outcomes. So, you know, both groups will be protected, but we expect to see a better protection in the group that addresses the DHT.
This is patients with COVID.
Yes. So COVID. Let me explain one more thing. We have a few study designs that we developed. As you know, there are various anti-androgens. So in dermatology, I think that you're going to use more of the DHT blocker, like the 5-alpha-reductase inhibitor, or some of, you know, even spironolactone, or maybe even flutamide. But when you get into the oncological side, they're using complete androgen blocking with things like enzalutamide. Now, those androgen deprivation therapy have much higher adverse event profile, even though they're, you know, most of the adverse events have been studied over a long period of time, because these patients do take it for a long period of time, these drugs. But we envision different types of study design. So I think that Carlos and our main interest has been really in the prophylactic treatment. And we think that the actual 5-alpha-reductase type of inhibitors, which do take a while to reduce DHT in serum and in tissue, as we know from hair, finasteride even, it takes probably about 14 days. We don't have a lot of better granularity data because it wasn't studied that way. But we would guess 7 to 14 days to get between 80 and 90% reduction, both in serum and tissue DHT. We don't know for sure in the lung it will reduce it. Like I said, it's produced in the lung, but we would guess it's the same in the lung as in the prostate as in the skull. So about 14 days prophylactically you'll take it. These are for SARS-CoV-2 negative patients. They will do test drive when it tests a negative 14 day, get tested again at day 14 or day 15. And then from then on, they'll continue for the next 45 days on the treatment. And then we will actually see both conversion to SARS-CoV-2 positive or whether hospitalization happens. So these studies have been designed with in mind of doing a healthcare workers, that are, as I said, SARS-CoV-2 negative, that are at least 3 times a week in touch with COVID-19 patients. And we calculated from that, from the number of contacts with patients, what's the chances that we can build a model around for infection. We were trying to, and maybe, you know, if somebody in this podcast hears this and has contacts, we've been trying really hard, including with the University of Colorado Oncology Department, to get to meatpack industry and be able to work with them as some sort of prophylactic, but we haven't been lucky enough to reach out to the right people there. As far as the other study design that we have is actually for COVID-19 positive. And here we're looking at mildly symptomatic patients and ability to give them either an ADT or an antiandrogen like a 5-ARI, and hopefully they don't convert into hospitalized patients. So these are the two kind of things that we have. We think that patients are already hospitalized. I'm not sure androgen blocking is going to help that much. I mean, once the virus has entered and caused all this infection, you have these cytokine storms and all these other things going on. I'm not sure that antiandrogen would really have the benefit that we're thinking about. We're thinking more on the prophylactic side.
Yes, and as of right now, there's a trial in UCLA, which is, they're using the Degerlix, a VA study, which is a chemical castration injection. So in the next day, there's no more testosterone. And there's another study in Johns Hopkins. They're using ivermectin, but also bicalutamide, which is an androgen blocking agent. So yeah, well, I think in the near future we'll have plenty of data or evidence from many groups
on the role. That's so fascinating. Mm-hmm. I think that the opportunity potentially to protect those vulnerable groups of patients outside of the healthcare industry is really fascinating as well. Our one of our campuses at Texas Tech is in Amarillo. And in Amarillo, there is a meatpacking plant nearby, and they've had significant trouble controlling infection rates in that community, so much so that at points they were looking at being able to redeploy faculty from our site here in beautiful sunny Lubbock, Texas, to help up in Amarillo. So I think that it would be a really great opportunity to help provide potentially some protective benefit for those patients in those meatpacking plants. And I can see if we have any contacts in Amarillo that could be able to help help coordinate that with you guys, because I know they've been looking at ways to protect that vulnerable patient population, which is largely comprised of refugees, actually, most of them from Somalia that are working in those meatpacking plants near Amarillo.
So we actually developed the protocol already that we have, and even we have the consent mm-hmm. forms because we presented it to a group of these. We haven't approached some of the I'm involved in all that, but I don't want to name any names of any companies, but we haven't approached every company in the industry, but we have approached an organization that represents the industry. We talked to one of their biologists. We had a call between University of Colorado and Colorado State, which is also involved in that. And these are, again, prostate oncologists, but they have a lot of interest in this. We have not had a chance over the last months, even though we presented them a consent form, we presented them the full protocol that we wrote. We're ready to go to IRB with, we just need a site. And these are drugs that, again, are, you know, we're talking about dutasteride, so there's not much known long-term effect, and this is a short-term study, but we think the benefits could be tremendous. What I have learned is some of these plants are about 5,000 people work there, and like in three shifts of 1,500 each. Yeah. So there's a lot of infection, and I think it's very interesting to try to study that and help in those kind of settings. I mean, that's just one setting, but yeah, if you have any contacts, I'm happy to send you the protocol and everything we can give. We're looking to help as much as we can.
Hey, Michelle and Luke, let me share with you some insights that, you know, Andy and I, we're kind of crazy. We like to explore some ideas that are like outside of the box. So yeah, I'd like to talk to you about something that I've been talking to Andy a lot, which is actually the shifts, the night mm-hmm. shifts. So
yeah.
So we're working on some manuscripts now, and we're waiting for some revision, some reviews about the effect of daylight mm-hmm. in the hormones. So we know that in the winter with less daylight, it's almost like a male hormone season, while with less daylight, which is over let's say 14 hours of daylight, it's more the female season. The estrogen receptors they're more expressed in the whole body with excess daylight. And and then you get IL-6 receptor. It's more expressed during times of light deprivation. So the inflammation pattern that we see with male hormones, which is more IL-6 driven, there's this DHT promotes IL-6 inflammation, and IL-6 inflammation boosts the effect of male hormones. So it is something that happens more during light deprivation. So let's say people who work in night shifts, sometimes they're there working with the artificial light, and then during the day they sleep. So their body is in a different sync with nature, let's say. And So artificial light can change or disrupt all the clock genes that are expressed in the hypothalamus by the visual effect of light. And we've been exploring that. We just submitted one article about the effects of altitude, elevation, wind, daylight, and what else? Population density in 91 cities of Brazil, which are all spread out with different daylight and different elevation. So we have very interesting, maybe in the future we'll probably modulate light, and that could maybe protect people from virus. Who knows?
Fascinating. Do you think that could play into the seasonality at all, since there's less light in the winter?
Yeah, so they've done a study on mice where they've shown that they looked at 16:8 versus 8:16, which means 16 hours of light versus 8. And there's a marked difference in androgen, actually, receptor expression. So we also know that there's another study that was done in mice that showed that, what was it that they did? They showed that how they can use, it wasn't light, they were trying to modulate the clock gene. So they did a knockdown of the clock gene, which relates exactly to that pathway. And they showed that they can block influenza. One. Yeah, mm-hmm. The period one clock. And they showed that they can block influenza with that. So that's exactly the theory that we have, is that what happens is the you have a light, a blue light receptive ganglion in your eye. It's not the same as the rodent cones that we have. It just receptive to blue light. And that synchronized the clock genes in the SCN. And that actually drives the period one is one of them. There's BML one, there's several ones. But period one specifically drives the androgen receptor gene expression. So we know that the longer the light, the 16:8, which is like peak summer, versus 8:16, which is peak of winter, like December, whatever the shortest day is, there's significantly less androgen receptor expressed just because there is not enough light. And there's also data now that shows that, and this is a separate study, that the prostate, in the prostate cancer, we know that PSA behaves also in a seasonal way. So there seems
early
to be
spring,
some...
right after the winter, there's a peak of PSA.
Huh. So again, 2 points make a line, right? I mean, I can tell you all you want one thing, but we have 2 points here that are very interesting. So we do believe that, okay, it's a theory again, that could explain potentially seasonality of many of these viral respiratory illnesses, not necessarily
Let me tell you something that is not theory now, Andy. So about seasonality, we're seeing the baseline now in the US. Do you agree with that? That the COVID cases dropped hugely, even with all the manifestations that have been going around.
Less I look at hospitalization. Yes, we have a lot less hospitalization.
And hospitalization even further. So the patients that who get COVID now, they are less hospitalized. So we've been seeing that. Now, why is that? Because in the winter, there were more cases now. The sun, is it the temperature? Is it the temperature? What's happening? So we have data from the equator, which is Belém, which is a city in the equator in Brazil, Manaus, there's a city, all the cities in the north of Brazil, they have a lot of cases of COVID-19, and they don't have seasons. They don't have winter. It's, let's say, almost like summer every single day of the year. So the daylight there is very stable at 12 hours all year long. So their influenza season is actually all year long. They don't have that stop during the summer. They have influenza all year long. And we've been seeing COVID-19 now all year long. They're like 25% of their population has been infected already. So it's way over everywhere else because they won't get this gap, which is caused by the summer. So what is the summer? Actually, the summer is in the subtropical areas, let's say north, so here in the US, or in Brazil, in the south of Brazil. And what happens is that daylight is extended way beyond. So it's like 14 hours of daylight, 16 hours of daylight. And that is needed to change the hormone levels or the inflammation pattern and everything. So there's some diseases that are polarized in the globe. So we see like multiple sclerosis happens more in the subtropical areas. Melasma, melanoma all those things, even though, you know, people live in the equator, why don't they have more melanoma there? They're exposed to the sun, there's more UVB light. So the daylight in our brains, in the hypothalamus, it can really trigger biologic events, which we've been ignoring. We've been like, well,
we know that from other things too. I mean, people think that the seasonal thing, it's actually seasonal gene expression affect a lot of things. We do believe animals, for example, mate in a certain season. Well, that's not random, and it's not just because of, you know, they felt warm today. Same thing with migration. I mean, there's a lot of things. Migration, we know, is actually light mediated. So, I mean, there's a lot of these different things. And yes, there's also magnetic navigation, and there's lots of other things. But I think one thing to point out is that this is a dermatology podcast, and we are going way beyond, but I do love working with Carlos because we're no longer, Carlos and I are no longer involved in dermatology research. We're now purely on the COVID-19 research with SARS-CoV-2, but no, it has been a fun, well, I wouldn't use the word fun, but it was been a great experience, and we're having fun researching and learning and doing stuff, but unfortunately it's a tragic time for everybody, including, you know, all the dermatologists and everybody, all our colleagues and us and our families and the whole world. But we hope that we can contribute to science at least, and explore all these great connections. I do think that light is interesting. I'm not sure that we can modulate it probably with blue light, but then we won't get sleep like we use our laptop all the time. But I think that I think this is, you know, everything has been so politicized with it, but I would say this, and I don't have any knowledge or no political interest in this at all. It's just that it does appear to me right now, and I don't have a lot of data, I'm not the CDC, that you will have, there's a huge rise in cases for whatever reason, social distancing, not enforced or whatever, but there are not a lot of hospitalization as you would expect from these amount of positive cases. Some of it is more testing, but from what I read, at least, it's more testing still does not correlate the increase in testing to the amount of patients that are actually being tested positive, which means that some of these social distancing and lockdowns are over. But again, not as much hospitalization as far as I know. And I'm not the CDC, so don't quote me on this. I don't have the exact number, but I think the hospitals, from all my colleagues who work in hospitals, they're not overwhelmed like they were before, which does bode well for our theory that, yes, you can contact the virus, but are you being hospitalized is the real question. I mean, I can contact a lot of things, but I'm not hospitalized. It's really, to me, a more important endpoint would be for the disease severity. So we're not seeing that. And so that's an interesting thing. And just for the heck of it, I'll throw this out there. And this is not any recommendation whatsoever to do anything. But the question is, if we build antibodies for that, and I'm not sure that we can or build antibodies, and I'm not sure how to mutate, does it make more sense to actually contract it during the summer, build your antibodies when you're less likely to actually get hospitalized, and then when the fall and winter comes around, you will be immune to this? Just something to bring up. I don't know if you guys have any opinion about that, but
yeah.
I'm not suggesting that, by the way. Whoever is hearing that, Dr. Gordon is not suggesting that.
I'm convinced we'll do COVID parties like the chickenpox parties of yore.
Yes.
I think, you know, the summer is the baseline. It's where we're more protected. And I think that's the period that maybe we should be out there and, you know, with minimal exposure. But, you know, it's better to, it's the period of the year that we should, you know, enjoy our life and life and go out and go to the beach. We should. I think that's important for life.
Yeah.
Forgive my ignorance. But I don't know about this ivermectin thing. What's the deal with ivermectin in COVID?
Oh yeah. There are some drugs that are being used outside of their package insert now. Just like hydroxychloroquine. But well, ivermectin, it was shown in vitro to inhibit the virus. And then since it's a drug that is available all over the world, genetics and people started testing. And there's been a preprint today that showed that ivermectin can protect and from severe disease, death. And so they had two groups there, and it was about 25% protection decrease in death rates.
It seems to inhibit like RNA synthesis, right? I think that there have been some previous studies where they're looking at encephalitis viruses, where ivermectin's also been used in the past. And it's crazy how many derm drugs have been involved in like the discussion of potential therapeutics for this condition. When COVID first came out and we didn't see the clinical presentations showing up as hitting the derm radar yet, I think some people felt like, well, this isn't going to be our fight. But then we keep having these cutaneous presentations and the connections to the axis of androgen sensitivity that we are more familiar with because we're, you know, intimately involved in the examination of the skin and the hair and all the appendages that are affected by it. So it's kind of really interesting how much dermatology is connected to this disease.
Yes. And I'll tell you something. I'm a fan of ivermectin. You know, ivermectin was the first antiparasitic drug to receive a Nobel Prize.
Wow.
It changed the life of the world, actually, because river blindness was cured with ivermectin. So all those microfilaria that caused disease, you know, in Brazil, in the Amazon, in the Western, I was a Navy physician in the Amazon, so I saw a lot of natives with microfilaria. And I'll tell you something, ivermectin does a miracle. It is a drug that changed the life of human beings all over the world, especially with river blindness. But, you know, it's also very effective for other larvae, strongyloides. So I published a beautiful case of larva currents, disseminated larva currents in one patient that was being treated for leprosy with high dose steroids. Becoming slim and dying. When I saw him, he had all those larvae all over his body, and I gave him ivermectin. After 2 weeks, the guy was muscular. So it is incredible. So it is a good drug for parasite. But the thing is that now these drugs are being tested for viruses. There's another one, which is nitazoxanide, maybe you would say here in the US, which is used for Giardia here in the US and the cryptosporidiosis or severe cryptosporidiosis in HIV patients. And in Brazil, it is approved for rotavirus and more viruses because the trials are impressive. When people take it prophylactically in ships and in cruises, they don't get rotavirus. And also, if you feed it in the first day, it shuts off the diarrhea in the first day. So nitazoxanide, it's been tested here in the U.S. for coronavirus as well. And I'm an investigator in one of the trials here at Brown. We expect to start enrolling patients. It's a post-exposure prophylaxis trial, so healthcare workers that were exposed to coronavirus, let's say without PPE, or they were like doing a procedure, we're randomizing them into nitazoxanide versus placebo, which is vitamin D. So it's exciting to think that there is some drugs with high potential. Personally, Andy and I, we would like to see more trials with antiandrogens. I think that's the key thing, but yeah.
The call is out there. Well, thanks again for coming on, guys. Is there any sort of final thoughts you'd like to leave? Anything else you want the people listening to this podcast to know?
Yeah, so, I wanted to share the data, the supplement 2 here in the podcast. Because you see, when we write the articles, it's so tough because we have to only write those 50 words or we cannot express everything. And I've been receiving a lot of comments from the article of Madrid. Many people are saying, oh, you're not comparing based on age. You're like, these patients, they are older, so you have more androgenetic alopecia. So it's, and they didn't read the article or there's a supplement now. So I'd like to compare this data of man and female here in the podcast.
That'd be great. You're talking about the Gebrin Sign article.
Yeah, Gebrin Sign, yes. Which is the the article that we evaluated in Madrid in three hospitals, 175 patients, 122 were male, and there were the female too. So if we check the Hamilton-Norwood scale over three, so 4, 5, 6, and 7, those patients are very bald. So those are the very severe alopecia patients that you can see from far away. So there was a study in Australia that below 55 years old, you would expect around 20%, 19% of the patients to be very severely bald. In the COVID-19 patients, we saw 30%. Now, if we go to the older age group, which is between 65 and 69, you would expect 33% of the patients to be very severely bald. In the COVID-19, we saw 70%.
So wow.
Much higher. And it seems to increase the gap, the difference between male pattern hair loss seems to increase with age in our patients. And if you think of the females over 70 years old, the largest study that saw the prevalence of 38% of females over 69, 70 or above, in our COVID-19 patients, we saw 57%, which is much higher.
Wow.
Not as expressive as males, but yeah. So we don't have the actual data from Madrid as the control group, which would be the perfect control group. We only have this data from previous studies in literature, but our friends in Spain who see their patients there and they are hair specialists, they know that it is higher than they would expect the prevalence. Anyways.
I'm convinced.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I just want to say one thing in conclusion too, and I know this is for dermatologists, many will listen to this, but there's been a lot of talk, and I think some of the concerns have been with pointing out baldnesses or pattern hair loss for COVID is that there is some sort of discriminatory effect or something that can be that we need to worry about people who are bald and them transmitting SARS-CoV-2 or COVID. And I think, you know, neither the data nor our suggestion is that. So I think whether you're in practice or whether you have a patient who comes in and says, you know, I'm really worried about it, the message is not, oh, you are actually going to transmit it to people and you're more. In fact, the message is you might be more vulnerable to if you do get it, but we don't know that for sure either. Also, there's another thing, and dermatologists might not be exposed to it as much, but when we talk about androgen, there are a lot of people who take androgen supplements. It's very, very popular, especially in the United States, and especially where I'm at. I'm in Newport Beach, California. So a lot of people, a lot of men use androgen supplements. And we also had some suggestion, well, whether I should stop it or not. And I think that's another issue that we always recommend to, I think we've been to several casts like this, is for these patients to really consult with their physician. I've heard on some interviews that I've been that a lot of people taking, obviously, without prescription, these supplements, and that obviously they should go see a physician for that. We don't know if it increases their risk or decreases their risk, but, you know, more research needs to come out on that. But I think we have something that we found very interesting and fascinating originally with androgen. There's a lot of implications, both for treatment, therapy, and in fact, maybe a prophylactic eventually that grows your hair and prevents to some extent. It will be the best
acne,
thing.
Yeah, everything.
Yeah, it solves everything.
Healthy people with manes.
Yeah, but so, you know, we hope there'll be a lot more research in that, and anybody who wants to get involved, and we have, I think, probably a dozen protocols that we developed for different scenarios with different anti-androgens. We're happy to share it with everybody. We have the ICF, CRF, so whoever wants any advice from us how to conduct these studies, we have a little bit of experience now with that. We're happy to help with that. So that's the final message I have.
That's great.
Awesome.
And do you guys want to share any sort of contact information or social media stuff if our listeners are interested in learning anything more about your work?
Sure. My email is Andy, G-A-N-D-Y-G, at appliedbiology.com.
Yeah, my email is Dr. Wambier, with W, W-A-M-B-I-E-R, at brown.edu. Oh, so I'd like to share something. Maybe some dermatologists are seeing patients with telogen effluvium now, both because of COVID-19 and also because of seasonality.
We talked about that.
So here's I have a medical student who is gathering data with other specialists of patients who were tested COVID-19 positive, and they are now with their telogen effluvium. So we're trying to describe how telogen effluvium happens after COVID-19, because we're seeing now, we have over 20 patients now, it seems to be very intense and very short. And wow, also faster than usual. So in the first 2 weeks, they already have. So anyways, if anybody wants to share cases, like a survey, we're gathering some data, trying to describe at least on some patients who we know were tested positive. Okay.
Wow, well, you guys, thank you for that. You sound very prolific, very intelligent, and it makes me feel inadequate, but fortunately, I'm
talking too much here. Congratulations for the podcast, by the way. I'm loving to hear them. I love your comments. Your both comments are, I heard a podcast about the New England Journal of Medicine article about actinic keratosis. I wish I had listened to that podcast earlier. So I was writing articles about that and commenting and addressing all the points that you made. Congratulations for the podcast.
Thanks so much.
Great job on this podcast. And I'm sorry I'm not on my video. I'm not that shy, but I just I'm in my gym clothes.
That's okay.
I'm in California.
Well, we can tell our listeners that Dr. Wambier has great hair.
Yes, he does.
We can only assume that Andy does as well.
Well, I can share my picture if you want. You can see my hair, but I'm in the video. It doesn't let me access my camera, so there you go. Why does it say no Zoom camera? Okay.
Well,
too bad.
Our listeners can Google Andy Gorin's hair.
Well, I am taking finasteride.
Full disclosure.
Full disclosure, but I've been taking it for a while, pre-COVID. So.
Oh, I switched my, I was taking finasteride for 20 years. I switched it to the test right now because of COVID-19, by the way.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, your hair looks great, so.
Thank you.
A good question is, you know, if you're taking finasteride, the 1 milligram doesn't actually, for hair loss, reduce, I think, serum DHT below 80%. I don't think so. Even long-term study, we need to look at that. If you take 5 milligram daily for BPH, I think it goes between 80 and 90%. Now, dutasteride gets even further down at below 90%. I mean, is there an advantage for COVID-19? That would be an interesting thing to look at and see whether patients in dermatology actually, if this happens to be protective antiandrogens, whether 1 milligram a day is sufficient to have some protective effect with finasteride. So I don't know that you need to switch to the finasteride, even if our theory is right.
Yeah. Maybe just take them both.
Yeah, why not?
Full androgen blockade.
Yeah, full blockade. Why not?
All right, guys. All right. Thanks again.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening, too. We appreciate you guys. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And that will do it for this bonus episode. Thanks for hanging around with us today, guys. If you would like to learn more about Dermasphere, including seeing or listening to more bonus episodes, visit our website, dermaspherepodcast.com. It's also a good way to get in touch with us and see some other fun stuff. Thanks to our institutions, the University of Utah Department of Dermatology, for supporting the podcast, and thanks to Texas Tech Dermatology for lending us Michelle. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. And you can find us next week. We will see you then.